Milo showed the driver Chet Corvin's photo.
No.
Out came Paul Whelan's DMV.
Yeah. You're sure?
He didn't tip me, said Grinstein.
Bastards, you remember.
Milo's attention returned to the log, eyes widening as they found the pickup address. Marquette Place, Pacific Palisades. Biro already had his cell phone out, preset to a map app. He fiddled, showed us the screen. Two red dots, Marquette and Evada Lane. Short drive between the two, 10 minutes tops under the cover of night. Milo said,
House or apartment?
Biro and Grinstein answered in unison, House. Grinstein added,
Dump.
Pacific Palisades. I expect nice.
Three derisive snorts. I said, The Palisades isn't your usual route?
I do Brentwood, sometimes Beverly Hills. There also you get dumps.
He threw up pudgy hands, the image of world-weary disillusion. That night you were in the Palisades because...
A guy was sick, said Grinstein. They call me, I say, okay.
Milo said,
How did Mr. Corvin pay you? Cash, paper, and stupid coins.
Another snort. I said, Cheapskate.
Bastard.
What else do you remember about him?
Nothing, said Grinstein.
Any conversation between the two of you?
I say good evening. He tell me where to take him. I say, okay. He say nothing. After that, I say nothing.
Three more snorts.
Bastard.
Raoul hurried to the station and returned with an LAPD mug, the blue, gold-trimmed kind given out to citizens who raise money for feel-good police projects. Grinstein tensed up.
No, I don't take things.
It's okay, sir.
It could be okay, but not for me,
said the driver.
I want only what is mine, not more.
The Hollywood station was a jumpier place than West L.A., the detective room filled with phoning, reading, writing investigators, multiple-line desk phones blinking, human voices vying with electronic noise. A couple of Palo Alto zombie types inspected computers. Others seemed lost in thought. Milo, Biro, and I convened in an empty interview room, sitting around the kind of table pushed to the corner to prevent suspects from feeling secure. Milo said,
Another address answers a hell of a lot of questions, Raoul, like a place to stash vehicles.
I said, Or worse.
Or worse. And if Meersheim's there, you may have cracked the whole thing wide open. Commissar.
Don't those guys wear fur hats? Said Biro. Don't want hathead. It's no big deal. Had no idea Grinstein could actually make a positive ID. I said, How'd you find him? There was nothing on the cameras, so I tried taxi companies and Uber, like you said, Milo. I started with taxis because Uber gets all pissy and wants tons of paper. He'd be less likely to use Uber, I said, not wanting to be on record using the app. That too, said Biro. Anyway, Grinstein was the third driver I spoke to. I got lucky. Milo said,
You're selling yourself short, Czar, but fine. Let's concentrate on business. First obvious step, check out the address. Even if the bastard's not there, there could be some serious evidence, so the goal is to actually get inside. I'm going to bypass John Nguyen and his lawyerly bullshit. Someone told me about a new judge, Sonia Martinez. Her brother was a cop in Oakland, got shot.
Heard that, said Raoul, but haven't used her yet. Milo said,
If I can pry Sean or Mo away from kiddie stuff like robberies, I'll get a drive-by done now. Just a quickie to get the lay of the land. This is not a stupid criminal, so if he is there, we can't afford to show ourselves and have him rabbit.
Binchy was out. Reed just back from dinner. He said,
"Sure."
"Look for the Taurus, the Ford truck, and the Camaro."
"No Ferraris or Bentleys? Shucks."
Milo said, "Next time we'll pick a .com bad guy." He hung up. Biro said, "The Sirius drive-by is way after dark."
"You bet, Emperor. He makes night moves, so do we."
Knock on the door. A Hollywood uniform said,
"Detective Biro, you've got a call from the lab on a case."
Raul said,
"Which one?"
"Benitez."
"Thanks."
Biro stood and buttoned his jacket. "Shooting on Argyle we got the day after Corvin. Nothing exotic, prescription drugs. This might even be the shooter wanting to turn himself in."
"Love when they see the light," said Milo. "Thanks again."
"What time tonight do you figure?"
"You're always an asset, Raul, but don't want to take you away from the wife and kids."
"They're in Colorado visiting her family for 2 weeks," said Biro. "First few days I tried to eat healthy and live right. Now it's microwave crap and ESPN reruns. Take pity and call me."
"Always happy to do a favor."
Biro walked to the door.
"You're joking, but I'm going out of my mind."
Milo drove out of the Hollywood lot. Slowly, no risk-taking. His mind elsewhere. I said, "Raoul's wife being away reminded me of something. Mearsheim's story about Donna visiting her mom. Her family are likely worried by now, would want to help."
"When we looked her up, we found nothing on social media."
"A controlling husband could explain that. Maybe birth records? Or back to the school district to see if she listed anyone other than Paul as an emergency contact."
"Good ideas, both of which will take time," he said. "I'll do it if nothing pans out at the house on Marquette."
I said, "Be good to know who owns it. Same for the house on Nevada, which, as Chet pointed out, is a rental."
Dick waving with Mearsheim. "Did you happen to notice how Mearsheim reacted?"
"Don't recall that he did."
"Guy came across so mild, sitting there and playing everyone."
"Part of the thrill," I said.
"Well, let's de-thrill him. Yeah, I'll look for the deeds on both houses before tonight."
His phone played 4 notes of Ravel's Bolero. The caller ID made him sit up straighter.
"Hey, Al, what's up?"
Ahern said,
"Giving you a progress report. We sure can't see any signs of excavation in the backyard. Between us and these walls, I did a little trespass over to the neighbors' trees, and nothing there either. My cadaver dog lady is away for a couple of days. I tried someone else, but no dice. So she'll be doing the sniff when she gets back. I've asked for an infrared thing. Should probably have that in the morning. In terms of the interior, we're waiting for darkness to do the luminol. So far, no obvious crime scene."
Each bit of bad news lowered Milo's bulk, like a dirigible steadily drained.
"Thanks for calling."
"Hold on! Saving the best for last," said Ahern. "We pulled up a usable print in the master bath. Corner of a shelf in the medicine cabinet. Nice clear thumb and forefinger. And Lordy B, Aphis knows who put it there."
"Please tell me it's someone with a record," said Milo.
"Nothing violent, and let's face it, we have no idea how long the print's been there. For all we know, she was a house cleaner. But so far, we can't locate her, which makes my nose itch. In a perfect world, she's what your doctor guessed, the new girlfriend. You want the basics on her?"
"I want everything on her. I'm driving. How about texting or emailing?"
"High-tech transfer of data," said Ahern. "My college kid thinks I'm a dinosaur. The other 5 do also." "Sure, coming your way."
Milo handed me his cell phone. The info arrived just as we reached La Brea and headed south. Trisha Stacy Bowker, 43, had a record beginning at age 19 and stretching 16 years. Convictions in Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Missouri
for petty theft, grand theft, larceny, embezzlement, illegal appropriation of property, and fraud. She'd gone years at a time without being arrested, pled out most of the time in return for probation or minimal jail time. Bowker's last bust, identity theft in St. Louis, had earned her a year of probation. No violations for 8 months had terminated her supervision after 6 months. I reread the record. She's been free and off the radar since a year before Jackie Mearsheim disappeared. Maybe she's kept her nose clean because she hooked up with a smarter criminal. Jackie's dead. Donna's dead. Bowker seduces Corvin, but has been playing house with Mearsheim for years. I said, why not? Couple of cons working lonely hearts. They hit on a winning plan and milk it. Fall for Paul, lose your money and your life. What does this princess look like? The mugshot photo Ahern had sent was tiny and indistinct, even under enlargement. Caucasian face topped by a thick, dark mop of hair. 27 at the time. A red light at La Brea and Beverly gave Milo a chance to examine the image. Damn, this is small. He put on reading glasses, squinted. Looks like 5'5", 128, brunette with a normal build. Could be. If Bowker is Mearsheim's girl, there was no abduction at the Sahara. All we really have on that is Sarah Beth Sarcer's description. But she was scared and meth-addled, so maybe what she really saw was two people hurrying off together. Or, he said, she saw things clearly, and Mearsheim decided to upgrade his hardware. Bowker's gone, too, I said. Guy like that, women are expendable, why not? He drummed the steering wheel with both thumbs. Sitting tall now, green eyes ignited. Got a lot to do. Starting with checking out old Trisha on a normal-sized screen. Then I start playing keyboard Sherlock. Chapter 48. A larger image of Trisha Bowker brought no new wisdom. Her face fluctuated between barely pretty and plain, depending on her mood at arrest. Some shots showed her as various versions of blonde, flat, dark eyes, no identifying scars or tattoos. Jane Average. That could be an advantage. Al Ahern's failure to find any recent data on Bowker didn't stop Milo from trying. No success. He printed what Ahern had sent him, included it in the murder book, went to get septic coffee from the big detective room. He returned, cell in one hand, coffee in the other, squeezed back into his chair, drinking, and saying, "Why do I subject myself to swill? Reed's not answering. I hope he kept it simple on the drive-by." 4 sips later, Reed was knocking on the doorway jamb, shirt seams strained by musculature, ruddy and toe-headed, your basic Viking raider.
"Phone ran out of juice, LT. Sorry. The house is small, oldish, in an area that's mostly apartment buildings. For the Palisades, I'd have to say a dump. None of the vehicles we're looking for were visible, but there's an attached double garage. You wanted it simple, so I only went back and forth twice. Can't tell you if anyone's inside, but there was no mail pile. So what's the plan?"
"Don't have one yet," said Milo, "other than I'm aiming for tonight."
"I'll stick around.
With lunch at 4, take along snacks, Moses. We don't want you fading." Reed smiled and flexed thigh-sized biceps.
"No problem with nutrition, LT. Been altering my workout. Heavier weights, fewer reps, a little creatine. Also, I watch everything that goes into my mouth."
"What was lunch?"
4 cans of muscle milk."
"I don't even want to know what that is."
"It actually tastes pretty good. Chocolate."
"Would it matter if it didn't?"
"Nope. I'll be at my desk. Let me know."
Too late to call the school board for info on Donna Wayland.
Milo tapped into county property tax records, found nothing, which fit her being a renter. With no info on her origins, impossible to look for family. He said,
"All else fails, dig up what you have. 7 years ago, Jackie gets disappeared by Mearsheim in Santa Barbara. Maybe he was already with Trisha Bowker, maybe not. Either way, with Jackie taken care of, Mearsheim looks for another victim, possibly finds one or more before he latches on to Donna. So what's Bowker's role in all this?"
I said, "Could be anything from confidant to full partner. If they're working as a team, she could have been used as a lure. Two women just happen to meet, become friendly. One lets on she's single and lonely. The other says, 'I know a good guy.'"
"With a nice job in the school district, like Jackie. Two districts hired him. Can you believe that?"
"Maybe he did his job acceptably. Some sort of technical work with minimal supervision. It does show he's bright. Anyway, whether or not there were male victims prior to Chet, Bowker was used to seduce him. He would have seemed the perfect target. Mearsheim had come to despise him for the way Chet treated him, and he understood Chet's overconfidence the way we did. Vulnerability." He shook his head.
"Idiots unable to imagine any woman who says she loves him doesn't mean it. Bowker's on him like a tracking device.
Passion, dinner, and jewelry. Maybe they had bigger plans, but Chet balked, so they killed him." He let out a sour laugh.
"Wages of Sin 101. Okay, on to real estate."
The rented house on Nevada Lane was deeded to a limited liability corporation registered as Scribble Properties. A bit of digging revealed that to be three people. Two living in Seattle, one in Austin, Texas. Bernard Levitin, Gray Winograd, Susan Minnelli. Three separate social network pages, but one story. A trio of TV writers, alumni of a long-running late-night show, had pooled resources by renting out their L.A. homes to leverage several Section 8 apartment buildings downtown. That in place, they moved to states with no local income tax. Nevada Lane had been Susan Minnelli's residence, so Milo began with her. Voicemail. Same for Bernard Levitin in Seattle. The converted Texan, Gray Winograd, wasn't home, but his wife was.
"This is Merrill. The police?"
Bored voice. Syllables elongated as if to prolong conversation. Milo said,
"This is about the property on Nevada Lane."
Merrill Winograd said,
"That place? Something happened? What?"
"We're doing a routine investigation."
"That sounds like movie dialogue. What did you say your name was?"
Milo repeated his credentials.
"Hold on. I just looked you up. And you seem to be the real deal. What's your actual police phone number so I can make sure?"
Milo told her. She said,
"You sound mellow. Guess I'll believe you. So what do you want to know about that place?"
"The tenants."
"No idea about any of Gray and his pals' little endeavors. It all goes through the managers they hired."
"Who are the managers?"
"Some company named Aswan, Asland, something like that,"
said Merrill Winograd.
"They're no great shakes."
"You've had problems."
"Apparently they're a humongous outfit, and Gray and his pals are teensy French fries. I keep telling Gray, being a landlord is a job, not a hobby."
"You said that place as if there'd been specific problems at Nevada."
"You're reading too much into that. I don't know details, and I don't care,"
said Merrill Winograd.
"The whole real estate thing isn't my thing. They thought they'd be tycoons. Meanwhile, I'm in Texas. It's kind of cute here, good food and music, but my allergies and, oh, God, the humidity." So you're not aware of any...
If there was a serious problem, Gray would be bitching about it, and he's not. So, how's the weather in L.A.?
Nice.
Figures. A call to Aslan Property Management brought up layers of manically paced, mostly incomprehensible, button-push instructions. Multi-city company specializing in shopping centers and huge residential complexes. Milo held the phone at arm's length as the robotic voice on the other end continued to natter. The zero for operator option brought up another automaton. He clicked off. I said, the castle moat for when tenants complain.
Give me some hot oil and a catapult.
The rented house on Marquette Place belonged officially to no one. Once the home of Herbert McLean, deceased at age 91, it had entered into probate 6 months ago because McLean had died intestate. The court-appointed trustee was an attorney named Mitchell Light, with an office near the downtown court building. Maybe one of those Hill Street hangers-on who dole out holiday gift baskets to judges and wait for assignments. That guess was kicked up to probable when Milo found Light's garish website featuring an improbably black-haired man in a bad suit whose cap-filled smile screamed trying too hard. Light's dual specialties were easing the grief burden of survivors as they enter the world of probate court, and speedily solving the problems of accident victims wronged by insurance companies. Milo said,
slip, fall, die. He's got you covered. Here goes more nothing.
To his shock, one of three garishly green 24-hour numbers on Light's site banner was picked up on the second ring.
This is Mitch,
said a radio announcer baritone.
What problem can I solve for you, my friend?
Milo told him. Mitchell Light, now subdued, said,
Police, I have no specific recollection of that property.
You're the trustee, Mr. Light.
I'm currently shepherding numerous estates through probate. The courts are overwhelmed. Everything crawls.
But you get your commission along the way.
Do you work for free? Said Mitchell Light. No need to be implicative, Lieutenant. I'll do my best to get you any information I have, if such information proves ultimately available and obtainable.
Thank you. When could you do that, sir?
In as timely a manner as circumstances provide. Assuming no legal roadblocks or other encumbrances materialize.
Could you give me an estimate, Mr. Light?
I'm in Cabo right now and plan to be back in 3 days. The process will begin shortly after, assuming no unforeseen circumstances.
Could a member of your staff check?
My staff is with me, Lieutenant.
Female giggle in the background. Milo said,
there's nothing you can tell me. Herbert McLean died at 91.
Good for him, said Light. If he'd written a will, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Clink of glasses, more giggling. Milo said,
how about the tenants? Can you recall anything about them?
Silence.
Mr. Light?
What tenants?
The place is currently occupied by...
That's unacceptable, said Mitchell Light. I do not allow tenancy in my properties, avoiding complications.
My properties? If probate went on long enough, his invoice would probably buy him the deed. Milo said,
what type of complications?
Some alleged heir shows up and carps about the rent or the management. I keep all my properties vacant, Lieutenant.
Someone's living in that one.
Then you need to investigate, and you need to mete out appropriate fines, penalties, whichever consequences are called for. When I return in 4 days, get back in touch with me. I'll certainly be initiating eviction procedures.
Do I have your permission to enter the residence?
Well, I'd think so, Lieutenant.
Could you put that in writing?
I told you I'm on corporate retreat.
How about by email?
Long exhalation, followed by a female murmur.
Mitchell Light said,
I will attempt that, but don't count on it. The internet's sloppy here.
Thank you, sir.
Preserving the rule of law, said Mitchell Light, is my passion.
I said, squatting made easy. Check probate records, find out who's not paying attention, and move in. Milo's desk phone jangled.
This is Susan Minnelli, said a crisp, confident voice. The police are asking about my old house. Why?
Milo said, The tenants are people of interest in a case, Ms. Minnelli. What can you tell us about them?
Some sort of financial thing?
Said Minnelli.
Can't get into details, ma'am.
You just did, she said. Okay, a money thing. Shit, why am I not shocked?
You've had money issues with them in the past?
They've always been late with the rent and haven't paid a dime for the past 5 months. I only found out because we just got the quarterly from the management firm and there's a big hole on that one. I demanded Aslan, the managers, deal with it. They said eviction is the only option.
They're being sloths.
My partners and I had already discussed hiring someone else. Now, for sure, as soon as the contract's up.
What a hassle, ma'am.
Real estate, said Minnelli. If I only knew then. So you can't tell me what's going on?
Not right now, said Milo. When that changes, I'll be sure to let you know. Meanwhile, don't try to make contact with the Whalens.
That's their name, said Susan Minnelli. Aslan just gives them a number.
Either way, ma'am, please keep your distance from them.
They're dangerous?
At this point, they're best left alone.
Great! I'm renting my gorgeous Pally house to criminals.
What, drugs?
Terrific. They'll probably take the carpets and the drapes and God knows what else.
We'll do our best to look out for you, ma'am.
Ma'am, that's nice. Like in Dragnet. Do you wear a skinny black tie?
On bad days.
Susan Minnelli laughed.
You sound like an okay guy. So, how's the weather in L.A.?
Nice.
Sure, why not?
Milo put the phone down with delicacy and pulled off as much of a leg stretch as the closet allowed. I said, They're squatting in both places.
The con's life.
That kind of transience, they could be figuring to move on.
God forbid.
He scanned his email.
Nothing from Mr. Light of the Universe. You heard him grant me verbal authority to enter.
I did indeed.
Two squats, gotta keep my eye on both. But I'm getting the hell inside Marquette.
Chapter 49 Judge Sonia Martinez was on vacation.
Fishing in Alaska. Hopefully a bear won't eat her, said Milo.
He called Biro for another name. Biro had nothing to offer. Several more calls finally pulled up Galen Friedman, a recent appointee with higher political aspirations and a rep as a cop groupie. His daughter just started the academy. Friedman listened to 15 seconds of Milo's spiel and said,
You've obviously done your homework. Bring the application to my house and you're all set.
Thank you, Your Honor. Where are you?
Friedman gave him an address on June Street in Hancock Park.
Terrific, Your Honor. Meantime, may I assume verbal
is sufficient? Said Friedman. You may. Go catch some criminals, Lieutenant Sturgis. And don't forget the little ones in December.
Which little ones?
Ill children are my fervent cause, Lieutenant. I chair an appeal for orthopedic hospital at year's end. It defines worthy.
I'm on board, sir.
You bet you are, Lieutenant.
After completing the warrant application, Milo said,
Just to keep things smooth,
and phoned Deputy D.A. John Nguyen. Nguyen said,
You're still after the loco cartoonist?
No, he's off the radar.
What then? Something's changed?
A lot's changed, John.
When Milo finished, Nguyen said,
You've built up the grounds. I could have gotten you in with any judge.
Didn't want to bug you, John.
Sure, that was it,
said Nguyen.
Friedman hit on you for one of his charities?
Sick kids.
See you at his party, said Nguyen. You'll get to see his house.
Freaking castle. But shit hors d'oeuvres.
Milo got a uniform named Shari Bostwick to deliver the paperwork to Friedman. She said, Hancock Park, ooh, and left. I said, no desire to see the castle?
Not tonight.
He stood, shook himself off like a wet dog, and tossed his jacket over his shoulder.
My real estate dreams are more modest. Let's see which troops I can convene.
Moroni was on a motorcycle trip to South Dakota, Lincoln visiting relatives in Birmingham, Alabama, leaving Reed and Binchy and anyone else Milo could muster. Everyone he talked to had reasons and excuses. The most he could get out of a harried sergeant was patrol cars driving by Evada Lane maybe 2-3 times per shift. Milo said,
appreciate it, but don't bother.
He phoned Raul Biro again.
What you said before, bored? Still that way?
Ready to shed my skin.
Okay, got something for you, but it's not going to actually be stimulating.
Biro said,
better than the alternative.
Milo told him to keep an eye on the Evada house.
Be there when the sun sets.
Another email check ended with a smile.
Miracle of miracles, Mr. Light of Day actually came through. Permission to enter the Marquette house by any means necessary. Okay, you go home and relax. Mo and Sean and I will handle it.
Smaller team than with Bit.
Given what happened last year, maybe it's better keeping it light and tight.
I'd been there when a raid on another house had led to a murderer being shot to death by an overeager rookie. Ruled justified, but the process had dragged on and the shooter had left law enforcement. I said, what time tonight? He looked at me. I said, all this foreplay and no climax?
Listen to you, Dr. Salty. It's the vest again, and you'll stand even farther back.
I'm getting used to the look, and I don't mind solitude.
Fine. But first, help me scheme.
Chapter 50. By 9 p.m., Milo and I were sitting in his unmarked, 4 properties north of the house on Marquette. The street was lit intermittently, but the moon was well nourished, and we had a decent view. As Reed had described, the block was mostly apartment buildings. The exceptions were an acre of land, fenced, weed-choked, waiting for development, and the plain little box Herbert McLean had lived in for 6 decades before dying without a will. You see throwbacks like that in L.A. People holding on, undeterred by real estate values as they seek the comfort of the familiar. Upkeep often suffers, and the house where Paul Mearsheim squatted looked unloved. The front yard was flat dirt and thistly stuff, the shingle roof checkered by bare spots. An old TV aerial perched on the peak. Drapes covered windows whose frames sagged and splintered. All that was missing was a dented, dusty sedan with original blue plates. In another city, the attached double garage might be deemed overbuilt for the puny structure. In L.A., built around the car, it made sense. Lights, dimmed by heavy curtains, illuminated the right side of the house, but so far no signs of habitation. Same situation at Evada Lane, per Biro's half-hour call-ins. Milo said,
if they've rabbited, I'm cooked.
I thought that had a culinary ring to it, but didn't comment. Situations like this, the less said, the better. Per usual, I had no role other than observer. Last year, that had expanded to witness. Subpoenaed on the police shooting, I'd spent unbilled time answering pre-cooked questions. Time passed. An itch developed over my left nipple. When it didn't go away, I unbuttoned my shirt, managed to get a finger under the vest, and scratched. Milo said,
"They put something in the fabric. Next time, be careful what you ask for."
I rebuttoned my shirt. I'm content.
"Foreplay,"
he laughed. Phoned Mo Reed, parked down the block south of the squat. Binchy was up a ways on the opposite side of the street. Both young detectives were in civvies, brown shirt and jeans for Binchy, black sweats, sneakers, and a knit cap for Reed. His weightlifter's chest swelled ridiculously by the vest. Milo had told him,
"Lose the hat, you look like the McBurglar."
Reed said,
"And I was going for secret agent."
Now, he said,
"Nothing, LT."
Same message from Binchy. The plan that had culminated with the suspect shooting had been a major production, featuring a day of serial surveillance by several vehicles and Reed impersonating a parcel driver. Tonight would be Milo knocking politely on the front door and, if spoken to, identifying himself truthfully. Keeping his voice light and unthreatening, calling Mearsheim Mr. Wayland, and explaining that he had a few questions to ask about Trevor Bitt. That might throw Mearsheim off, but chances were the door knock would be immediately threatening. If Mearsheim tried to escape through the back, Reed and Binchy would be there waiting. If things went really south and he barricaded himself in, everything would change. If that happened, and Trisha Bowker was in there with Mearsheim, hopefully she wouldn't end up a hostage. Or worse, a co-combatant. High risk, but the rationale for doing it this way, and I'd supplied part of it, was criminal predictability. Psychopaths are, at the core, boring creatures of habit. What we knew about Paul Mearsheim suggested he was a high-functioning psychopath, a lifelong con, and a murderer who'd never been arrested because he operated with finesse. His performance the night of the Braun murder had been Oscar quality. My best guess was that, certain he could talk his way out of anything, he'd avoid impulsive violence and opt for cool, calm, and outwardly harmless. But that was only a guess. At 9:32, headlights appeared from the south, reaching Binchy first. He called.
"Not sure, but I think so."
Cars had been coming and going on Marquette at a thin pace. This car turned up the driveway of the McLean house and parked in front of the right-hand garage. Silver Taurus. Milo pulled out the night binoculars he'd cadged from a detective assigned to protecting dignitaries. The Taurus's driver's door opened. A smallish man got out and walked to the front door. Easy gait, no backward glances as he unlocked and stepped in. I said, "Like he owns the place." Milo called Binchy and Reed.
"It's him. Leave your vehicles in place and proceed on foot. You know the rest."
Within moments, both detectives had snuck around to the back of the house. No movement from inside the house. Milo waited 15 minutes, checking his watch every 5.
"Okay," he said, "it's 10:10. In Asia, double numbers are good luck."
He got out of the car, smoothed his jacket over his holster, and proceeded toward the house. I found a spot we'd agreed on. Shadowy niche of a neighboring apartment building, mostly blocked by a huge rubber tree. He'd wanted me to stay in the car. I'd negotiated. The tree clinched it, overgrown, a vegetative umbrella. I watched as he reached the house's front door, knocked, waited a few seconds, and knocked again. His big form tightened up as a crack of light appeared between door and jamb. Talking to someone. Tensing up. He pulled the door open, gun out as he rushed in. Seconds later, Binchy and Reed were out front, following him inside. Guns, but no gunfire. I took that as everything going smoothly, waited a few moments, and made my way over. Paul Mearsheim, newly bearded, his head shaved clean, lay on his back, one arm folded beneath his body. His mouth was agape, his eyes dull. A black hilt, plus an inch of butcher knife blade, protruded from his chest. His throat had been slashed, flesh separating in a wet, ruby grin. Milo and Binchy and Reed stood around the body. They'd holstered their weapons and looked stunned. The woman between the young detectives shook and wept and clutched her sides with bloody hands. Each of them maintained a hold on her arm. 40s, average build, short blonde hair, a pleasant face. Donna Wayland had lost weight since posing with her school district co-workers. She wore blue jeans, a white top, pink running shoes. Everything splotched and speckled with red. Blood acneed the wall behind Mearsheim's body. Folds in his shirt front created opportunities for the blood pooling. Crimson arterial blood. Some of it, commandeered by gravity, trickled over his narrow chest and spread on the floor, purpling old gray carpeting. Fresh kill. Donna Wayland's hands clenched. She began to hyperventilate. Milo said, "Breathe slowly." She shut her eyes and sucked in air. Began forcing words out between gasps.
"He said he was kill me. I..."
Pointing to a shotgun lying 6 or so feet from Mearsheim's right hand.
"He... I... had... to..."
Bringing a knife to a gunfight had worked. Somehow. My brain became a fast-shutter camera. Sobs racking her body. But no tears. Walking around the four of them, I peered at Mearsheim's corpse. No way to get a look at the hand pinned under his body, but the one I could see bore no defense wounds. The throat slash had smooth borders. No hesitation marks. A massive wound that screamed murderous confidence. Lopsided, beginning with an upward swoop that began at the left side of Mearsheim's skinny gullet and climbed to just under his right ear. Right-handed slasher. Coming from behind. No sign of a struggle. The shotgun. Too far to have been dropped by a mortally wounded man. Placed there. Donna Wayland was looking at me. Everyone was. The house had gone silent. For a split second, her face changed. Theatrical terror given way to cold analysis. A face I'd seen before. Cold-eyed, flat, barely suppressed hostility. Portrait on a collection of mugshots. I said, "Hi, Tricia." Her shoulders jerked as she resisted reflexively. That elicited Reed and Binchy's reflexes, gripping her harder. Milo took his cuffs out. Like a virus taking hold, cop suspicion had set in, and everyone knew it. Four sets of eyes settled on Donna Wayland, a.k.a. Tricia Bowker. She was inert for a moment, shuffling through a mental Rolodex for the right facial expression. First came a pout, bizarrely girlish. Even as it settled, she knew it wouldn't work, and switched the channel to a pathetic mule. Milo cuffed her. She sagged as if trying to slip the restraints. Reed and Binchy held her fast. Milo turned his back on her and assessed Mearsheim's body. He spieled the Miranda warning, not even trying to sound interested. With nowhere to go, but it's either fight or flight, Donna, Tricia was in no position to fight.
It was... I'm so sorry. Please.
That didn't work. She spat in Milo's face. Once it's over, some criminals check out mentally. Tricia, Donna, cursed and kicked and screamed as Reed and Binchy removed her. Milo allowed himself some rapid breathing. When he stopped, new sounds asserted themselves through the thin walls of the cheesy little house. Low-pitched barks, muffled but insistent. What might have passed as an asthmatic dog protesting. Then the noise began to sound human. Binchy came back, saying, "Mo took her in." Milo and I were already moving toward the sound. Front of the house, the south side. The garage. The space was accessible through an empty service porch that reeked of bug killer and sported small heaps of dead roaches. No bolt on the interior door. A turn lever that Milo's gloved hand flipped. Dim garage. One bare bulb screwed to a socket in the rafters. Parked side by side, a black Ford pickup and a black Camaro. A chair was positioned between the vehicles. Moth-eaten love seat from another era. The figure in the chair bucked and screamed through a duct-taped mouth. Body and limbs were pinioned to the chair by more tape. The eyes above the gag were flickers of terror. Male captive, barely able to see through swollen lids, unsure now if life had gotten better or worse. Pipe-stem arms, stringy hair, blonde, matted, greasy. His gray T-shirt was blood-caked. Brown stains on his jeans coexisted with more blood, amoebic blotches of red. A crusted yellow circle marked the concrete near his bare feet, where urine had settled and dried. The garage stank of gasoline and cleaning fluid, and more insect poison and shit. Several feet in front of the chair, near the rear bumper of the Camaro, lay a bloody ball-peen hammer. The captive's right hand was a mangled blob. Milo rushed toward him.
"Police! It's okay! It's okay!"
He began removing the tape gag as the boy in the chair convulsed. Binchy's eyes had shifted to a corner of the garage. He pointed.
"Oh, Lord!"
A band saw just beyond the nose of the pickup. As Corey Thurber's parched, swollen lips were liberated, he made a gagging sound and drooled and struggled to speak. As Milo began freeing his arms, he managed a whimper that began feebly and continued to lose power. Barely audible.
"Help me."
Milo said, "It's okay, son. You're safe. Just hold on."
Chapter 51. Once you know what to look for, collecting evidence is a whole new game. Within 10 hours of Tricia Bowker's arrest, the earliest link between her and Paul Mearsheim was found. The couple had gotten together 9 years ago when Mearsheim had worked as a computer consultant for a school district in Massachusetts, and Bowker had served as a teacher's aide. Shared amorality had been the relational glue. Both had used sanitized bios to obtain the public sector positions, a pattern repeated as they traveled westward. Mearsheim's resume leaving out several dismissals by financial firms due to irregularities, Bowker's criminal record omitted. Helping that along was the adoption of a new joint identity, the pseudo-married duo of Paul and Donna Wayland. Bowker, with solid talents as an identity thief, had usurped the personae of a couple who'd perished in a 1958 New Jersey house fire. Claiming matrimony had been a cinch, No one ever bothered to check marriage licenses. For years, the Whalens had combined gainful employment at various public and private schools with illicitly obtained government handouts and on-the-side schemes, mostly slip-and-fall insurance fraud. From everything Milo could tell, their first homicide had been Jacqueline, Corey's mother, a widow enticed into what she thought was legal marriage with Paul as he continued to spend fun time with Bowker. No murders between Jackie and the brutalities of the current case surfaced, but he was still looking. The search for biological evidence was complete within 48 hours. Bloodstains and shreds of flesh in the teeth of the bandsaw blade at the Marquette garage matched to Hargis Braun's DNA. Shotgun cartridges found in a kitchen cabinet were consistent with fragments embedded in the ruins of Braun's face. The garage floor had been washed with ammonia and insecticide, but luminol glowed heavily in one corner of concrete and several feet of the tar paper walls above. Tex had also discovered blood specks in the bed of the pickup truck and two errant hairs matching Braun's in the hallway of the still-being-processed Evada house. Also in the Marquette home were a pair of crotchless leopard-print women's panties, several wigs, including a brunette hairpiece whose strands matched those taken from the A-frame by Milo, and a silver filigree necklace set with amethysts. The necklace was confirmed as the one sold to Chet Corvin by Bijan Amani, owner of Snowbird Jewelers in Arrowhead Village. Amani also picked Donna Trisha's brunette-wigged photo from a six-pack lineup, as did Brianna Muldrew, assistant manager of the San Bernardino Hampton Inn. Presented with what Milo chose to share of all that, Trisha Bowker, the DNA-confirmed wearer of the bracelet and the wig, was enthusiastic about talking to him, per her public defender, a tired-looking 50-year-old named Hollick Wild. Initially surprised by my presence in the county jail interview room, Wild recovered and said, "Great, this is at the core of a psychological situation. The more insight, the better." Bowker read a prepared statement. As she recited, Hollick Wild smiled with self-satisfaction. That and stilted legalese made clear who'd put it together. Simple theme, Paul Mearsheim bad, Trisha scared and intimidated, an often unwilling Confederate. She described how Mearsheim had shotgunned and mutilated Braun in the Marquette garage, wrapped the body in thick plastic sheeting, bound it with duct tape, then transported it back to Evada Lane in the pickup. There, shielded by darkness and the quiet of the cul-de-sac, he'd transferred the object to the Corvin house. Milo said, "Why there?" Trisha Bowker seemed pleased by the question.
"Exactly. Because he hated Chet. Chet was always making fun of him."
"Where are the hands, Trish?"
"I don't know. He took them somewhere."
"Where?"
Glance at Wild. The PD said,
"Honestly, she has absolutely no idea."
"Okay, let's move on. Trish, you and Paul go way back."
Brief whispered conversation between Wild and Bowker. She said,
"A bit."
Milo said,
"How long's a bit?"
"A while. I'm not sure."
"9 years is what we've learned."
Hesitation. Trying to figure out where this was going. Another glance at Wild. He nodded. She said,
"That sounds about right."
Wild said,
"Milo, all that time points out the severity of Trisha's situation. She suffers from Stockholm Syndrome." To me, "You know better than I. It's a chronic disease, which, when untreated, persists."
Milo said,
"9 years ago, you and Paul were an item when Paul met Jackie."
Silence from Bowker.
Wild said, "We'd love to help, but is this relevant?"
Milo said,
"Fair enough."
Back to Bowker. In terms of your relationship, would you say Paul was in charge?
Always, said Bowker. Control was his total thing, his primary drive, his obsession.
To me, he had an obsessive narcissistic personality disorder. He was like a movie director, domineering and dominative, like those wigs he made me wear. Everything was a production.
Milo said, wanting you to go brunette.
Wanting what he wanted when he wanted.
You went brunette when you hung out with Chet Corvin in Arrowhead.
It's what he wanted.
Chet or Paul?
Both, I guess.
And here I was, thinking blondes had more fun. So Chet liked the wigs, too.
Another control freak, she said. He put me in negligees. I had to do all sorts of things.
Role-playing.
Pout. Eyelid flutter.
Everyone molds me like I'm clay.
Milo checked his notes.
When Paul brought the body back to Evada Lane, how did he know he had enough time to position it before the Corvins returned?
Bowker's reply was too quick, a well-trained dog responding to a hand signal.
He knew because he saw them leaving and talked to Chet. Chet was bragging as usual.
Bragging about what?
About how they were driving all the way to Restaurant Row, even though no one but him wanted to.
Another controlling guy.
I sometimes don't make the best choices, said Tricia Bowker.
Wilde cleared his throat.
Bowker said, I'm no expert, that's for sure.
On men, said Milo.
On life.
She pouted, strained for tears, produced a droplet, and gave up.
I don't know how it got so messed up.
Milo nodded, spent more time with his notes.
Okay, if the Corvins had stayed closer to home, what was the plan?
Bowker's eyes left-shifted. Her body echoed the same route as she turned to her lawyer. Wilde said,
If you know, sure.
Bowker said,
I don't. The plan was Paul's.
Did Paul have a contingency plan for what to do with the body?
Wilde said,
She already answered that.
Bowker said,
I really don't know.
Got it, said Milo. But could you take a guess, seeing as you knew Paul better than probably anyone?
Hmm, said Tricia Bowker. He could just wait.
For?
Another time.
To bring the body to the Corvins.
Yep.
Putting the body in Chet's den was important to Paul.
Chet demeaned him all the time. Paul decided to get him. He watched him, all of them.
Sudden passion in her voice, shared anger. She realized she'd overstepped and drew her head back.
Look, I can't tell you anything factual, just that Paul was a monster. He hated Chet, but basically, he hated everyone. He's a hateful, hateful person, always planning.
To Wilde.
Can I tell him about the alarm?
Please do.
Here's an example of how premeditative he was, sir. He learned their alarm code by watching her punch the keypad and memorizing. He's got a great memory, a long memory. He gets vengeful.
Her being?
Felice. He was always playing up to her, being Mr. Softy. Different from Chet, that was the key. He even stole a key from their kitchen.
The beginnings of a smirk. Slyly collaborative. Again, Tricia Bowker caught herself and turned theatrically grave.
It wasn't even necessary. They didn't even put the alarm on. Paul told me. He bragged about the whole thing.
The Corvins made Paul's job easier.
Sure did.
She shifted in her chair, working hard not to gloat. Milo shuffled papers. Without looking up, he said,
Another thing that made Paul's job easier was your wrapping up the body and helping him load it into the truck.
Wilde's mouth opened. Bowker said,
No, no way, sir. I never did any of those things.
What did you do when Paul was wrapping and loading?
Nothing. I was just in the house.
Which house?
The little one.